organizing this wonderful meeting, such an interesting, eclectic group of scientists. Today, I'll be reviewing several aspects of what might be called the multicritical universe, but it's really a review of the theory of gravity with anisotropic scaling, and in particular, focusing on conformal aspects. And by conformal, I don't mean just conventional conformal invariants, but also anisotropic conformal symmetries and Weyl symmetries, which we'll encounter in several places as we go along with the talk. So let me start by explaining the title of the talk, the multicritical universe. It's a scenario which uses anisotropic gravity, the approach that I've been advocating over the past few years, to try and seriously face the possibility of coupling this type of gravity theory to matter. And as ingredients in this multicritical universe scenario, in order to get the physics side right, you want to start with the standard model of elementary particles, or your favorite beyond standard model scenario, maybe a UV completion, gut theory, or maybe some form of supersymmetry, which is Lorentz invariant. And in principle, at least we know how to make it UV complete, so I'm not going to invoke any fancy extra degrees of freedom. Instead, when I try to make this compatible quantum mechanically with gravity, I would like to couple this to what I would call multicritical gravity, which starts with the idea of combining gravity with anisotropic scaling and tries to use the improved UV behavior to make sense of the dynamics at short distances instead of having to invoke some additional, maybe stringy degrees of freedom. This theory flows to isotropic scaling in the infrared, and you can try and minimally couple these two sectors together. And this has very interesting, robust consequences because of the fact that Lorentz invariance is broken in the matter sector only through the coupling, through the Newton constant, essentially, to the multicritical gravity sector. You get calculable small corrections to the dispersion relation of matter in the matter sector. And this might be interesting from the point of view of recent speculations. Last September, when I was at CERN, there was a very interesting and somewhat controversial announcement by the OPERA experiment. They reported perhaps a superluminality of matter at a certain level. The atmosphere in the room was very exciting. Lots of people were excited about seeing some groundbreaking physical discoveries. A few hours later, I went back to the room just to make sure I take this picture, just in case. And the room was empty, and the excitement was kind of gone. But I would want to stress this question mark here. The fact that the OPERA experiment may have not conclusively showed any superluminality of matter doesn't mean that we should not look for small corrections to Lorentz invariance. So I still think it's a very interesting experimental question. Ultimately, it's going to be nature itself that tells us whether Lorentz invariance is violated at some level. And it makes sense to look for some corrections to Lorentz symmetry, especially if we can embed things into a consistent mathematical framework, and in particular in the standard framework of Wilsonian quantum field theory, if you can calculate consistently corrections to the Lorentz invariant dispersion relations, it's worth doing and checking against experimental data at some point. So in this talk, I would like to start with a longer overview of quantum gravity with anisotropic scaling before I can set up the multicritical universe idea itself. So part two will be relatively short. I'll be mostly just combining what we learn in part one and suggesting some phenomenology scenarios, essentially beyond standard model physics induced due to the presence of gravity with anisotropic scaling. And then in part three, I want to switch topics completely. And again, within the context of quantum gravity with anisotropic scaling, I want to point out several other places where conformal symmetries of various sorts play an important role. And in particular, our recent two papers show that for non-relativistic versions of ADS-CFT correspondence, which perhaps condensed matter people might be very interested in, both Lipschitz gravity and the ideas of anisotropic Weyl symmetries and anomalies play a central role. And in particular, we'll also see a very explicit appearance of conformal Lipschitz gravity in the structure of counterterms. So that's a completely different Point three here is a completely different place where conformal symmetry and anisotropic scaling in gravity shows up. It has nothing to do with 3+1 dimensional gravity of our universe. Instead, it provides holographic gravity duals for non-relativistic field theories. Some references. The idea of gravity with anisotropic scaling goes back to these two papers, and these three dots refer to about 700 papers that have appeared since. So I'm not going to be very inclusive in terms of citing other people's work. Some of our recent papers are these two on two separate topics. The first one is closely connected to the CDT approach that Renate was mentioning. The second one is the holographic renormalization in Lipschitz spacetimes. And if you want a short review, you can look up this particular paper. I should mention my brilliant collaborators, Charles, this year graduating, going to IPMU this fall, Kevin, Patrick, Tom, my students, Senke Shu, a condensed matter theorist who at the time we worked on the project was at Harvard, now is at Santa Barbara, and we've recently worked with Steve Carlip and his students on the CDT approach. So let me begin by what will actually end up being a large part of the talk, a review of gravity with anisotropic scaling, which is independently interesting. I would like to thank Renate for mentioning several important concepts which will be very useful for me. So you'll see the reappearance of things like little lambda and so on. And once we are done with this lengthy review, we can see where we can find interesting applications of this idea. So gravity with anisotropic scaling, that's what other people often refer to as Hochschild-Lipschitz gravity, is simply an idea of combining, within the conventional quantum field theory approach, anisotropic scaling, where you take spatial dimensions, scale them all for simplicity with the same scale factor, but you scale time with a different power of that same scale factor with gravity. This anisotropic scaling is quite common in condensed matter systems. We know beautiful quantum field theories which realize this type of renormalization group scaling with all kinds of interesting values of z. If your theory is exactly relativistic, it of course forces z to be one. If you look at, for example, at the non-relativistic Schrödinger equation, it will have z equal to 2. You can have examples of field theories with all kinds of interesting values like integers, but also fractions, for example, the Cardar-Parisi-Zhang surface growth problem in 1+1 dimensions gives an exact critical exponent 3/2. This z, known as the dynamical critical exponent, in other words, what I'm saying here, is a very important observable associated with a fixed point of the normalization group. So this is actually the first place where conformal symmetry comes up, because to me, personally, probably the most important, if I had to pick one most important reason why we care about conformal symmetry, it's the fact that it is a symmetry associated with the normalization group fixed points. And if you want to understand the general behavior of quantum field theories, you want to understand fixed points first. So that's why you may want to be looking at conformally invariant systems first. When I say conformal, I mean it in a generalized form. For example, when you have a theory which has this anisotropic scaling with z not equal to 1, then the natural definition of what you mean by the conformal symmetry is the group that consists of space-time isometries, but also this anisotropic global rescaling. So there wouldn't be any conformal boosts as a part of the symmetry, but it is the natural generalization of what you mean by conformal. Maybe one may want to distinguish scale versus conformal, but I'll be using the word conformal in this sense. It's the largest symmetry compatible with the form of scaling that is given to you by the value of z. So as I said, this is quite common for quantum field theories in condensed matter, but it has never been until quite recently combined with the idea of a fluctuating spacetime geometry being the fundamental set of field theory degrees of freedom. So what I want to do is to start with some fluctuating metric in the path integral language and ideally end up with a theory which has propagating gravitons and some form of anisotropic scaling, especially at short scales. It is an attempt to use the improved ultraviolet behavior due to the anisotropy to control the possibility of a UV completion by a fixed point using the metric degrees of freedom. So this is, in a sense, a very conservative quantum field theory approach. starting from the observation that for all other interactions, quantum field theory has worked extremely well. And if there is at least one additional feature we can try, we should definitely see if we can improve our understanding of gravity using conventional quantum field theory. This can be compared or contrasted with the asymptotic safety program, which has been advocated by Steven Weinberg and others over the past 25 years. It's an idea which is very similar in spirit. In both approaches, we are looking for a UV fixed point for gravity without substantially changing the degrees of freedom and while using the conventional Wilsonian picture of quantum field theory. The difference is that in asymptotic safety, the search is for a non-trivial RG fixed point because the insistence here on relativistic symmetries forces you outside of a weakly coupled system. So if there is a fixed point, it's inevitably strongly coupled in the natural degrees of freedom. And it will be, as a result, very difficult to calculate from first principles. In my approach, on the other hand, again, we are also looking for ultraviolet fixed points of the normalization group, but by giving up relativistic symmetry at short scales, you open up the possibility of having nearly free field theories dominated by a free Gaussian fixed point in the ultraviolet. And then you have to ask, however, in this approach, what happens at long distances as you flow away from the UV, the hypothetical UV fixed point with some value of z greater than 1, how do you restore the approximate Lorentz symmetry? And that is a very interesting question. I'll have some comments on that, but it remains one of the main open problems or open questions in this setup. But generically, it's true that generically you flow from z greater than 1 to z equal to 1 under the influence of the relevant operators that you can add to the action. So if you look at, we'll see examples, the theory near the ultraviolet fixed point, it gives you a certain set of relevant deformations, and those will induce a flow in the infrared. You'll end up at least reproducing isotropic scaling, which is already a good starting point for getting closer to Lorentz invariance, if that's what you're interested in. So this is interesting for several reasons. I guess for many people, primarily the main reason to be interested in this is here listed as number 5, which is perhaps this gives us a new insight into how to understand gravity in our universe of 3+1 dimensions, in which case we have to really explain the high degree of Lorentz invariance and all the observational tests of GR, both astrophysically and cosmologically. But I would like to argue that as long as the theory is mathematically self-consistent, it may have many other applications. Regardless of whether point number 5 here is successful or not, it can still be a useful theory for things like the holographic duality for ADS-CFT correspondence of non-relativistic systems. Or you can pick your own favorite application from this list. Many of you have seen this transparency before. The update of the status of this theory. This is a Dutch map of California as an island from the early 17th century. So I think we have similarly discovered something interesting. We don't have all the details in place yet, but we are working on them. Let me start by explaining a simple field theory system, which will be useful later for several reasons. Which has this anisotropic scaling with z equal to 2. It's the so-called Lifshitz scalar field theory. I've oversimplified perhaps, but this is a Gaussian fixed point with 2 time derivatives of the field phi on the same footing as 4 spatial derivatives. Delta is the spatial Laplace operator. And I'm systematically splitting space from time. So x, I are spatial coordinates parametrizing d, capital D spatial dimensions, plus I have 1 time dimension. So in order for these 2 terms to scale the same way under the RG, you have to postulate that z is equal to 2. Time has to scale twice as fast as space. And this is, of course, in contrast with the conventional Euclidean quantum field theory of a scalar field whose action in some little d dimensions would be written down here. They have very interesting features when compared to each other. These 2 theories both predict that the classical scaling dimension of the field phi is d minus 2 over 2. So in both cases, something interesting happens when d is equal to 2. The theory is at its lower critical dimension, and you have a classically infinite number of marginal coupling constants. That explains the importance of the two-dimensional sigma model in the relativistic setting and also underlies the success of string theory, because you can, in fact, by generalizing this to a theory of n scalar fields, parametrizing some n-dimensional Riemannian manifold, you can derive Einstein's equations from the requirement that the quantum beta function for this interesting classical system is also zero. Here, in the Lifshitz scalar field theory, this critical dimension has now shifted to 2 spatial plus 1 time dimension. So this system is interesting in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and we have seen a shift in the critical dimension of the system. And we'll see how similar things happen for gravity as well. Basically, the idea is that by raising the value of z, you change the UV behavior of the system, and the critical dimension typically goes up. So if you recall that the conventional relativistic gravity would formally want to be at its critical dimension in 2 space-time dimensions, this might be a way of raising the critical dimension of gravity as well. So let's start with basically implicitly invoking Renate's notation. Kij here is the extrinsic curvature of slices of constant time in space-time. So I'm starting with a space-time where even before I put in any dynamics, even before I define what I mean by Riemannian geometry, I put in a preferred foliated structure of space-time. So at the level of the differentiable structure, the manifold is foliated. This, by the way, is intentionally put in to eliminate the famous problem of time in attempts to quantize gravity. And we'll put a bunch of fields on that space-time. We'll put a conventional space-time metric, but we'll write it in this decomposition. The only difference between my notation and Renate's is that my spatial index is ijk and not abc, but other than that, you can use the same notation. So this is the lapse function, the shift vector, and the spatial metric. I'll postulate symmetries. So I'm following the usual approach of quantum field theory, effective quantum field theory in particular. I'll postulate fields and symmetries, and then I'll write down the most generic action that makes sense compatible with those symmetries. The symmetries will be foliation preserving diffeomorphisms. So those will be generated by, I think they might appear on the next, no, I'll get that later. They contain space-time dependent spatial diffeomorphisms of the slicing of the manifold M by slices sigma of constant time. They also contain time-dependent and time reparametrizations. So per space-time point, there's one fewer symmetry compared to GR, and this is, of course, going to be important in the counting of degrees of freedom. And then I write down the generic action. So this little lambda here makes an appearance. Kij is a fancified time derivative of the spatial metric, which is, of course, geometrically known as the extrinsic curvature of the leaves of constant time, but it's more practical for the purposes of this talk to just think of it as Gij dot, the time derivative of the metric. And we are mimicking the structure of the Lifshitz scalar field theory here. We're writing down a kinetic term which is of second order in time derivatives. This is the most generic one compatible with this gauge symmetry. I do have 2 coupling constants. One I chose to write down in front of the whole thing. The other one is this little lambda, which is known from the David metric. And then you get to choose your favorite potential term in the action. I'm using, again, the non-relativistic terminology. So these are the only terms that will contain time derivatives of fields. Then I can introduce a bunch of fields compatible with this gauge symmetry that contain derivatives of things like the spatial Riemann tensor. As long as I can contract everything to form a scalar here, I can choose anything in this particular place. So that's where you get to choose your favorite value of z. Depending on which dimension you're in, you might play different games. The simplest example would be to pick z equal to 2, just like for the Lifshitz scalar, in which case you may want to write down a potential term which would look something like this. It would have, let's say, the square of the Ricci tensor, the square of the Ricci scalar. These dots here stand for operators of lower dimension, which I could also add. But since for now I'm only interested in defining a short distance UV fixed point, I'm only looking at the leading operators of the dimension equal to the dimension of the kinetic term. Those are the ones that will define for me the Gaussian fixed point when you linearize this around, let's say, a flat space-time solution. I've also left out things like the square of the Riemann tensor, which you could write down, and you should, generically in arbitrary dimensions. I left it out for a good reason here, because this theory is actually very interesting when d is equal to 2, in which case there isn't enough room for writing down an independent Riemann tensor squared. The theory is interesting in that particular dimension precisely because, again, there has been a shift in the critical dimension of the system. Yes?
Generic question. So you gave up four-dimensional deformorphism in invariants.
Correct.
You introduce elapse and shift as new fields.
Okay.
But you don't give them kinetic terms. You put in principle, not knowing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So this will. So you just arbitrarily decide.
I'm building the theory in steps. So far, I haven't really written down the most generic action. I'm just discussing specific examples. We haven't even talked about the distinction. What you are referring to is essentially the distinction between the projectable and the non-projectable version of the theory. So
I want to understand this philosophy underlying why you introduce fields that don't make them dynamical if you don't have in mind making it.
I completely understand what you mean. Let me. I promise that this will be definitely very clear on the next few transparencies. So we observe the shift in the critical dimension of the system. So in 2 plus 1 dimensions, this is a theory which is power counting and normalizable. Of course, we haven't talked about the details that Ben just raised, but I'll get to that on the next transparency. If you take the minimalistic approach and you say that the lapse function should be only a function of time, you can consistently make that restriction because the lapse function is a gauge field associated with time parametrizations. Just as much as the shift vector is a gauge field associated with space-time dependent spatial diffeomorphisms, and that's the reason why it's in the theory. The shift vector is the gauge field associated with spatial diffeomorphisms. The lapse function can be consistently restricted to be a function of time because the time parametrizations are only a function of time, and n is effectively their gauge field. So if you make that restriction, this is known as the projectable version of the theory, and you can easily quantize this theory and check around flat space that you have just one extra degree of freedom, a scalar graviton, and you have tensor polarizations, which are familiar from conventional GR, and both of these degrees of freedom would have a dispersion relation around this ultraviolet fixed point where omega squares to k to the fourth, roughly speaking. Now, speaking of the observable effects of this little lambda parameter, little lambda shows up in the dispersion relation for the scalar graviton. So that's how you observe the physical value of lambda. It shows up in the scattering properties of the scalar graviton. There are two special values of little lambda. We saw that already in Renate's talk. There is 1 over d, which in her case was 1 over 3, because I'm here in arbitrary spatial dimensions in general. That's the conformal value. That's where the generalized Debye metric becomes degenerate, and you get classically a conformally invariant kinetic term under anisotropic conformal transformations. More about that in a minute. Another special value is 1. It's actually selected even before we mention general relativity, because it's the edge of a region at which you don't get any ghosts in the spectrum. If you look at the dispersion relation for the tensors, they look like the dispersion relation for non-relativistic gravitons independently of the value of little lambda. If you look at the dispersion relation for the scalar graviton, it would become ghost-like within this region between 1 over d and 1. So as long as you stay outside of that region, your scalar graviton is not a ghost degree of freedom. It has a conventional physical dispersion relation. But little lambda shows up, of course, as an observable through that effect. You can construct other examples. This is just a brief mention of how you can construct something interesting with z equal 3 in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Again, it would coincidentally be classically and isotropically while invariant with quantum anomalies. Now, back to the issue that was raised about the presence of fields n and ni. So we could have started with just a theory of a spatial metric, Gij, and not postulate any other fields. In that case, you could show that the theory has many propagating degrees of freedom because essentially all of the components of the metric would propagate. So you'd get essentially a tensor and a vector and a scalar, which might be interesting for Tevez oriented people, but it's not interesting for me because it's a theory with very little gauge symmetry. In fact, that theory would have only spatial reparametrizations, but not time-dependent spatial reparametrizations. In order to get this full diffeomorphism invariance under foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms, you need to gauge symmetries. And as I said, N plays the role of the gauge field for this guy, and I plays the role of the gauge field for that guy. And that gives you the choice of being able to restrict N to be a function of time. If you do, what I was saying at the earlier transparency is correct. You get an extrascalar graviton polarization. But if you don't, if you allow N to be a function of space-time, you can start from that more general starting point. In that case, you are dealing with the so-called non-projectable theory. This is connected closely to this apparent confusion that seems to be persistent in the literature about GR with a generic lambda parameter. It always boils down to what are the correct gauge symmetries of your theory. You can follow different strategies. You can postulate a gauge symmetry. In this case, if you postulate space-time foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms, you have one fewer gauge symmetry per space-time point. You are instructed, as any effective field theorist would, to write down the most general action that satisfies those invariances. In that case, you have a new possibility of writing down terms that contain the spatial derivative of the Laplace function, because this is compatible with gauge principles. And if you do, then it turns out that the theory develops a consistent second-class constraint. You can do this for arbitrary potentials of higher derivatives in spatial dimensions. And turns out that the theory then, again, propagates both tensor graviton polarizations and the extrascalar graviton. Now, if you don't, if you artificially leave out terms like this from the action, then you might end up predictably in trouble. And that's exactly what happens when you postulate the form of the Hamiltonian here. So in that theory up here, you had two choices. You could say, yes, there seems to be a persistent question.
But in the projectable case, you still have a solution to the problem of time because you have N as a function of T3.
There is no problem of time in that theory.
So if you vary, are you allowed to vary N of T?
Of course, yes.
It's like a parameterized particle, isn't it?
Okay.
And so there's still a constraint?
There's a global constraint. Okay, so if you leave out terms like this, then the Hamiltonian will indeed take the form written on the blackboard, but generically it won't. It will have a more complicated structure because it will depend in a more complicated fashion on N. You have two choices. You can either say, I do insist on this form of the Hamiltonian. Can I possibly make sense of it despite being apparently inconsistent because I've left out important terms from the action which would be compatible with my symmetries? The only way out is to actually declare by hand this system to be secretly a gauge-fixed version of GR. And if you do, then you're forced to choose the potential term to be only of this form written on that blackboard. You cannot add higher derivative terms in the spatial directions. And of course, you have to impose this Gauss constraint that you have missed because you didn't realize until now that this was a gauge-fixed version of GR. And that's the pi equal to zero constraint on top of Minkowski. If you don't interpret this as a theory with a gauge-fixed higher gauge symmetry, then you have to face up to the fact that this term is now present in your ingredients, how to construct the most generic effective action. And when you write down the most generic effective action, there is no inconsistency, and I don't see any problem with it. Yes?
There are strong reasons for believing that the normalizing quantum field theory is gauge invariant. This avoids coupling to physical modes. But in your quantum gravity, you're violating the gauge invariance of the theory, namely different local invariance and local invariance.
I'm not violating any symmetry. I'm postulating a certain consistent set of gauge symmetries. I'm postulating a set of fields, writing down the most general action that satisfies those principles, and quantizing it and finding a consistent theory.
But look, inviting local provincial.
I didn't say anything about Lorentz invariance. I mean, this is a theory which does not postulate Lorentz invariance is not a mandatory symmetry of quantum field theory. So if I write down a non-relativistic quantum field theory for condensed matter, I'm not violating Lorentz invariance. It's still a consistent theory, it's just not Lorentz invariant.
And Lorentz invariance is a local gauge theory of quantum gravity.
We don't know that.
Well,
it might be a local symmetry of general relativity if you write it that way, but I'm not talking about general relativity here. I'm talking about a quantum theory of gravity with anisotropic scaling. And so again, we get a non-relativistic dispersion relation. I wanted to stress that this little lambda for consistent spectrum is supposed to be on the outside of this gap. And we'll see, perhaps, if I don't run out of time, an interesting refinement of this in the holographic normalization in Lifshitz spacetimes.
So you have to pick option two or
that? Either one is fine. One or two are fine, but for holographic normalization, I'll be forced to pick option two because I will allow the metric to be acted on by anisotropic wire transformations, and that needs the Laplace function to be a spacetime field. So there's a special case.
So is that the scalar graviton coming from there or somewhere else? There is an extra scalar in the theory, right?
There's an extra scalar.
So it's in the option two only?
No, it's both options. There's always an extra scalar graviton, unless, again, there are three options what you can do with it. You can either live with it, you can try to gap it, or you can invent an extended gauge symmetry. If this were a different talk, I would talk about non-relativistic general covariance, where you can actually extend the Fourierian preserving diffeomorphisms by one extra local gauge symmetry in order to eliminate the scalar as an unphysical gauge artifact of that extra gauge symmetry.
You say graviton scattering depends on lambda, but can you claim that this is observable? In principle, yes, but in practice, we're nowhere near being able to observe such a thing, right?
Well, we are asking whether lambda is potentially giving a physical observable, and I'm claiming yes.
Graviton scattering is not anywhere near what we can hope to observe experimentally.
So maybe you should go home and do something else.
In conversation with the previous talk, where the effect that the lambda was postulated to have something to do with it was a relatively straightforward and cosmological observation about the universe.
I'm talking about the observables in principle.
There's a big difference in regards to current observational status now between the two
right. Lambda observables. Well, I can give you a completely different view on lambda. Little lambda, for example, in holographic normalization of theories with anisotropic scale invariance produces the anomaly term that the quantum field theory is known to possess. So that's another observable feature. It has nothing to do with whether or not this describes the physics of our universe as we observe it now.
But the final question, in either option one or two, do the gauge symmetries prevent you for the Laplace function not to be non-propagating? So many more time with this. Does the gauge symmetry, is that enough?
Yes. There's a special case of these models, just like the spatial potential piece in the Lifshitz scalar action was of a special form, namely the equation of motion of a Euclidean d-dimensional theory squared. Laplace phi is, after all, the equation of motion coming from the variation of the relativistic scalar action. You can generalize this to the case of gravity. Theories which satisfy this extra condition are known to are said to satisfy the detailed balance condition for historical reasons, and in particular cases in gravity, for example, if we start with gravity in 2 plus 1 and we insist that the theory satisfies the detailed balance condition, it would mean that the equation of motion, the potential term would have to come from squaring the equation of motion of some action of gravity in two dimensions. Famously, of course, we have no equation of motion coming from the variation of the topological invariant that the Einstein-Hilbert action becomes in two dimensions. So in that case, a theory with detailed balance in 2 plus 1 dimensions would have a potential which is identically zero. in 3 plus 1 dimensions, you can generate by using the Chern-Simons 3 form as the 3-dimensional action, you can generate an interesting theory with the Cartan tensor squared as a theory with detail balance. This condition of detail balance seems like a technicality, but it will actually come back when I talk about holographic normalization modulo the time constraints of the talk. So what I proposed so far is, roughly speaking, an outline of how to define the theory at short scales. What happens at long scales? For the Lifshitz scalar, you can define a UV fixed point by the z equal to 2 action that we talked about, and then you can start adding relevant terms to the action, and it turns out that you have two interesting relevant terms. You have the usual mass term, but you also have the so-called, so to speak, missing spatial part of the relativistic kinetic term, the things that go as second spatial derivatives of the field phi. Both of them can be multiplied by a dimensionful constant and added to the theory, and if you don't do this, then once you start adding interactions, these terms, these relevant deformations would, in any case, get generated by quantum corrections. So you might just as well add them at the beginning and ask how the theory flows under the influence of these relevant terms. And clearly, depending on the sign of this mu squared, you may or may not reproduce the conventional kinetic term for the relativistic field, but either way, you end up scaling with z equal to 1 as a result of this relevant deformation of the theory. Compared to the conventional relativistic scalar field theory, we have also another new and exciting possibility. We can add this with the wrong sign compared to the relativistic scalar field theory. And if I imagine stabilizing this theory by adding some phi to the fourth or such interactions, you can then show that having this coupling constant here with the quote-unquote wrong sign is very interesting because it allows you to access a new phase of matter, namely a spatially modulated phase. So the ground state in that regime would be spatially modulated, and that explains why all these concepts of higher derivatives that I've been adding and then deforming away from has to do with the idea of multicritical systems. The Gaussian fixed point in the UV that we started with that has z equal to 2 is an example of a multicritical fixed point, and there are multiple phases as you explore the plane of deformations under these relevant terms. So similarly for gravity, these dots stood for adding all the remaining lower dimensional operators, and you see that accidentally from the RG point of view, the two most important terms that will dominate in the infrared just happen to be the scalar curvature and the constant. So those are exactly the same two terms that appear in the ADM decomposition, in the Hamiltonian rewriting of general relativity. So at least the form of the action will accidentally look like GR without any tuning. Of course, there's still the discrepancy of having this little lambda around and having this extra scalar polarization of the graviton. So you have to be careful not to identify this theory with GR. But either way, again, you end up flowing to z equal to 1 scaling in the infrared. And this is completely tangential to the interests of this workshop, but I want to mention at least in a few words that these z equal to 2 or z equal to 3 gravity fixed points have been constructively demonstrated to appear also as infrared fixed points in certain lattice systems inspired from condensed matter. So they can play the role of infrared physics as well. Renata mentioned the causal dynamical triangulations, so I'm deferring to your understanding from her talk or from previous talks you may have heard. There are these beautiful results of the CDT approach, which for the first time give us a chance at a continuum limit of gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions, with the spectral dimension being 4 in the infrared, but magically reducing in a crossover behavior to effectively 2 at short distances. Now, I would propose, as I did, I think, in February 2009, that this actually is a behavior expected from the mean field approximation, classical limit to continuum gravity with anisotropic scaling, where the reduction down to 2 is not due to some complicated topological feature. It's simply due to the anisotropic scaling, where the spectral dimension defined by putting an auxiliary diffusion process on top of a space-time with anisotropic scaling actually ends up being 1 plus d over z. If you have d spatial dimensions, each scaling with the value of z not equal to 1, you see effectively a smaller dimension, even though the topological dimension and the smoothness properties of spacetime still stay the same. So you're looking at a D plus one dimensional geometry, but because of the anisotropic scaling, you see this crossover to effectively two spectral dimension being equal to two. So that's the first hint of what I would suggest in more generality, namely that the CDT approach is related to Lipschitz gravity in the continuum, just as lattice QCD is related to QCD, that we are looking at perhaps different regularizations, but in the sense of taking the universal observables, we are seeing the same features, same structure. So Renata drew this phase diagram here, and I want to point out that these types of phase diagrams, again, are very typical of systems with multicritical behavior. For example, the Lipschitz scalar itself, if you look at plotting mu squared and m to the fourth, allows you to, if those deformations are both zero, you're here at the multicritical point, but you can access those three phases now that I mentioned. So it's a multicritical point that defines the three in the UV, and then you can flow in several different directions. There is, of course, a staggering similarity between this diagram and that phase diagram, which makes you wonder whether we can reproduce this gravity behavior. This is just the redrawing of Renate's picture, except I switched A and B, apparently. So you can ask what happens with the phase diagram in the case of gravity. Again, you have these two most important couplings, and clearly in the infrared you get a relativistic dispersion relation for the gravitons, but you can still ask, what if I choose wrong signs in various places? Do I access different phases of gravity? And the answer is yes. If you look at the simplest possible example in 2 plus 1 dimensions, let's postulate the FRW cosmological ansatz for some round metric on a sphere. A sphere because I want to compare to CDT, and CDT is notoriously much easier to do on a sphere than on an infinite hyperbolic plane. So I'm dialing the spatial metric to be a sphere with some scale factor A, and then I'm trying to solve just the mean field equations in Lipschitz-type gravity with anisotropic scaling. And again, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, it's sufficient to have z equal to 2 as the defining multicritical point. And when you solve the classical equations of motion, they essentially come from the Friedmann equation, just like in GR. That's the constraint that we talked about earlier, which is still present in principle because you have time reparametrization invariants. You find that there are three phases. In one, I would call it De Sitter-like. It's not quite De Sitter in the sense that you don't get a round sphere. You get a family, which depends on these two coupling constants, of deformed spheres. In some regions, this looks very, very much like De Sitter, almost a perfect round sphere. In some regions, it gets distorted more into an American football shape. But in any case, that's the phase that we would match onto this phase C of the CDT approach. We also see another phase where the spatial size of the sphere just keeps oscillating in time. There's a nice phase transition between them, which I think looks like the Einstein static universe or something. And then there's a third part to the diagram. There was a third part which Renata also didn't explain in detail. I'm not going to explain this in detail because we find out that under the FRW ansatz, there is simply no solution in that region. So what we found now is a solution which is outside of the FRW ansatz. It's inevitably spatially modulated. You have to violate spontaneously some of the naive symmetries of the spatial slices. It's no longer going to be just the FRW cosmology. So this region here is conjecturally a modulated phase of gravity. So presumably that gives a prediction for what the CDT approach sees. We have also studied some aspects of this story in a recent paper with Steve Carlip and his students. And there we actually found an interesting surprise to us. In this setting, it's not quite clear whether you are forced to impose the global Hamiltonian constraint, because you're certainly not required by local space-time diffeomorphisms to do so, unlike in GR. In GR, this would be a mandatory constraint. Here, you can let the computer simulation choose whether it wants to impose the constraint or it doesn't. And in fact, in 2 plus 1 dimensions in the CDT simulations that we did with Carlip's group, we indeed saw a phase transition which suggests a deconfinement of this constraint. On one side of the phase transition, you see a Desiderio-like behavior. So you're forced into satisfying the Friedmann equation. But then there is a sharp phase transition. And on the other side of the phase transition, you see just a static sphere without satisfying the Hamiltonian constraint. And it's true that if you look into the code, there is no particular place where the global Hamiltonian constraint would be imposed. That's my understanding, at least, of the story. So this is a dynamical question, whether the spatial integral of the Hamiltonian density is zero or not in this theory is more of a dynamical question. Now, since we are talking about conformal invariances and conformal structures of things, let me introduce a very important symmetry which happens to be compatible not with full spacetime diffeomorphisms, but once you have a structure of a preferred foliation in your spacetime, you have spacetime foliation preserving diffeomorphisms, you can introduce this particular generalization of wild transformations. You rescale your spatial metric with some arbitrary scale factor. This little omega is the same that Renate was using. So we even match notation most of the time. You are forced to scale the shift vector with the same factor of omega. But as it turns out, you can now choose how to scale the lapse function. You can choose your favorite value of z and scale the lapse function with omega to the power of z as opposed to omega to the power of 1, which would be forced in GR. These anisotropic wild transformations form a closed algebra with the foliation preserving diffeomorphisms. And they're actually quite important, as we'll see, in various different places. They make an appearance when you, for example, try to define the structure of conformal infinity of spacetime in non-relativistic holography. Penrose's definition of conformal infinity is not sufficient. It needs to be modified. And it has to allow for this anisotropic conformal structure. And I should say that this also is useful not only when your entire spacetime is fully foliated by preferred foliation, but also in the more general set of examples when the spacetime only develops an asymptotic foliation near infinity because of the set of boundary conditions that you are prescribing on fields, such as in ADS-CFT with certain boundary conditions.
And what type of product is that?
It's a semi-direct product.
Semi-direct.
Yeah. So these anisotropic wild transformations are very interesting because you can now ask many questions that we have understood so well over decades in relativistic quantum field theory. For example, you can ask about the structure of wild anomalies for non-relativistic field theories. This is surprisingly not a very well-studied field. We actually have to do many calculations from scratch just this past December, and more of them will appear in our next paper in a few days. So let me focus on the most interesting, simplest case of 2 plus 1 dimensions with z equal to 2. That's a theory, that's the case where there is enough room for interesting anomalies in anisotropic wild symmetries. You start with some kind of a classically wild invariant theory, such as the free Lipschitz scalar field in 2 plus 1 dimensions would be classically invariant under these anisotropic wild transformations that I mentioned. If you assign the scaling dimension 0 to the field phi, it turns out to be invariant under these in the general gravitational background. And that classical theory, when you calculate the quantum effective action, may develop an anomaly. The anomaly will be given, of course, it will be linear in this omega parameter. It will be given in terms of some local density made out of the fields in the background. The simplest examples involve two-dimensional conformal field theories, which famously are characterized by one central charge. And the thing that then shows up in the anomaly is just the space-time scalar curvature. Here you can actually classify all possible terms that can consistently appear in this type of anomaly in 2 plus 1 dimensions with z equal to 2. So this is a cohomology question. You do the BRST calculation. You find out there are two linearly independent cohomology classes that can show up as the anomaly. The first one, interestingly enough, is the kinetic term of conformal Lipschitz gravity with z equal to 2. This is special value of lambda equal to 1/2 is that conformal value that I was mentioning. So this is something that comes out of the cohomology calculation. And then there is another possible piece that can show up. It's roughly the spatial curvature squared of the 2 plus 1 dimensional geometry, fancified by terms that make it conformally invariant under wild transformations. So this statement says that any 2 plus 1 dimensional field theory with z equal to 2 scaling can have two types of anomalies, so it's characterized by two central charges. Whether or not any of these central charges vanish or are non-zero is a dynamical question that cannot be determined by looking at some Sambierski cohomology. It has to be calculated. And when we did the calculation, it turns out that we get interesting results, which I'll report on in a minute. So as I said, the kinetic term of conformal gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions happens to be precisely of the same form that we saw in the previous transparency in the appearance of this anomaly in anisotropic wild transformations. That's not a coincidence. And there's an interesting other feature of this, namely, if you insist on constructing a classical theory of conformal gravity at the Lipschitz point with some value of z, and in addition require that the theory satisfy detailed balance, then in 2 plus 1 dimensions, this is the most generic form of such action. In other words, this term, you can also add to the action. It would also be anisotropic while invariant, and of course it's invariant under foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms. But this term violates the detailed balance condition. This will be interesting when I talk about holographic normalization. But I wanted to wrap up before I try to mention some of the... How much time do I have?
Well, we started 8 minutes late, and so time is up just now. But
okay.
This is the interesting part.
All right. So I'll be very brief about the multicritical universe, because it's a phenomenological proposal, which would be more interesting to have a PH audience rather than a GRQC audience. It's simply an attempt to combine in the minimal possible setting the standard model of particle physics, or your favorite beyond standard model extension, which is, of course, Lorentz invariant from scratch. In the minimal possible way, you want to combine that with the simplest UV-complete Lipschitz gravity theory. So you may want to dial z equal to 3 in 3 plus 1 dimensions in the absence of the coupling between these two sectors. The matter sector will be exactly Lorentz invariant. That's my postulate. I'm building a bottom-up phenomenological scenario. But once I couple Lipschitz gravity to matter, the coupling, the irrelevant coupling to the matter sector, to the gravity sector, will mediate some calculable violations of Lorentz symmetry in the standard model sector. And again, this generically predicts some energy-dependent superluminality of matter suppressed by scales that are present in the coupling between these two things. So if you want additional information on this, I recommend Maxim Pospelov, who's been one of the leaders of theories of this approach. He can fill you in on many more interesting details of this scenario. But again, there are a few model building approaches you can take. There are interesting relations. The Newton constant in the gravity theory is not a fundamental constant at the short scale, because it only shows up as a coupling constant in one of the relevant deformations of the theory. And that has interesting suppression effects. You can try to combine this with the ideas of supersymmetry and or extra dimensions a la Randall-Sundrom, which has interesting consequences. So I'm mostly just advertising this for discussions. We can have private discussions of this scenario later. But since we are talking about conformal symmetries, I wanted to mention one really important place where conformal symmetries played a role, and that's the ADS-CFT correspondence. In the standard setting, you have entire Sitter spacetimes, and conformal symmetries in the Minkowski geometry, which is dual to ADS by the duality, are realized as isometries of ADS. Here in Lipschitz cases, if you are interested in designing holographic duals for theories with Lipschitz-type scaling for some value of z, you have to modify the bulk geometry, because your conformal transformations are now different. They essentially consist of anisotropic scaling. To get that type of conformal symmetry in d plus 1 dimensions parametrized by x and t with some value of z, you design this spacetime. This spacetime does not solve Einstein's equations. And you have two options. Either you postulate some weird form of matter so that Einstein's equations are forced to be satisfied, which you can always do. It's just a question of how crazy the matter sector becomes. Or you can modify gravity and try to find a theory of gravity where the Lipschitz spacetime is the vacuum solution. So since I'm out of time, I'll have to be brief, and I'm skipping lots of the technical details. But you have two options. So if you start with relativistic gravity with matter, which is what people historically have done over the past few years, there is some matter system consisting in the simplest scenario of a massive vector. You dial parameters in a certain way, and you find out that your theory is your Lipschitz spacetime is a solution. Then you try to check the structure of conformal infinity of spacetime, and you find out that Penrose's usual definition, after all, here we are doing relativistic theory in the bulk, it's just GR coupled to relativistic matter. So we should be trying Penrose's definition of conformal infinity, except it doesn't work, because for these Lipschitz spacetimes, it does not give you this codimension one non-relativistic boundary. Instead of that, the standard definition of conformal infinity gives you a line, just a timeline, and that doesn't correspond to what we expect from holography. So you can modify, as we showed with Charles a few years back, Penrose's definition in the cases where the structure of spacetime is at least asymptotically foliated. And this anisotropic conformal infinity uses the anisotropic Weyl transformations in place of relativistic ones and gives you the right structure of conformal infinity. Then you can perform the holographic renormalization in this theory, which means that you want to make sense of the theory with a cutoff where the boundary is not quite at infinity. There is some regulator. Long story short, you perform all kinds of technical analyses, and you find out, finally, that the anisotropic Weyl anomaly, which is now explicitly calculable by a classical gravity calculation on the bulk side. Now, remember, I'm performing this in option A, which is relativistic gravity with some crazy matter. You find that the entire anomaly reduces to this term, L tilde 0, which is, as you can recall, only the first of two possible terms that can show up in the anomaly. The conclusion here is that if you do relativistic gravity coupled to the massive vector field in the bulk, then you can only reproduce dual field theories which have only one of these central charges non-zero. The other one would have to vanish automatically. So you can ask, why is this the case? Again, there is a lengthy argument I don't have time to review. But it turns out that it's implied by the structure of the recursive relations among holographic counterterms in the bulk. By the way, these holographic counterterms, they all take the form, as we saw here, they all take the form of bits and pieces of conformal Lipschitz gravity with z equal to 2 on the cutoff boundary, which is an interesting independent result here. So then you can ask, are there any theories? Again, I'm skipping lots of interesting details, but since I'm out of time, I don't have a choice. So you can ask, is there any known quantum field theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions which would actually have both of these central charges non-zero? Because so far, all the examples in the literature, they happen to have CV equal to 0. We found a family of examples which are Gaussian field theories. There's a non-minimal coupling to the gravity background, and if you dial gamma, you can influence the value of CV. So this family of theories, we claim, it has two independent central charges. So how do we make that happen in the bulk? Again, long story short, you postulate Lipschitz gravity in the bulk. Since you're doing holography for non-relativistic systems, it would be kind of foolish to force the theory to be artificially relativistic at all times in the bulk. So you write down the most generic low energy theory. This is, by the way, that very important term that goes like the spatial derivative of the Laplace function. It has a very important coupling alpha in front. I also have this little lambda parameter, which we've discussed all morning, this morning. And when you start with this Lipschitz gravity in the bulk, turns out that if you choose this alpha squared coupling constant to be precisely this, then the Lipschitz spacetime is going to be a solution. And that still leaves you with one, again, this is a longer calculation. It leaves you with one free parameter. It's this famous little lambda that we've been questioning its physical importance this morning. Here, this little lambda directly gives you the value of the other central charge of the dual field theory. So it's a very physical quantity. It's as important to 2 plus 1 dimensional non-relativistic field theories as the central charge of 2 dimensional conformal field theories is. And here it's set essentially by dialing the value of lambda in the action. So it's definitely an observable on the dual side in the field theory. It plays a physical role. So that's all. I think I should just conclude here. Random comments, if somebody is interested, there is some bizarre mathematical isomorphism between this framework when the detailed balance condition is satisfied on one hand and Fernlinde's ideas of entropic origin of gravity. It's tied together by Onsager's variational principle for non-equilibrium thermodynamics. It's completely mysterious to me why that's the case. But the conclusions, I think I'll leave up to everybody to decide. So, thank you.